according to Matthew. Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and undergo great suffering at the hands of the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and on the third day be raised. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, God forbid it, Lord. This must never happen to you. But he turned and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me, for you were setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things. Then Jesus told his disciples, if any of you want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit them if they gain the whole world but forfeit their life? Or what will they give in return for their life? The Gospel of our Lord.
For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake will save it. Let me just say up front, this is not a threat issued by Jesus or some moment of judgment. It's like, now we're watching you to see if you screw it up. It is an observation. And it is based on Jesus' experience of life in the Palestine in the first century. And I'll just put it out there right up front. And one way to translate this now in this life, in the 21st century, and in our experience, is to imagine all the ways that you and I come up with to find things on the outside to fix our insides. And we do all kinds of wild things, and not just us as individuals, but we do this as a culture. All this stuff on the outside that we tell ourselves is going to make us feel better or more connected on the inside. An example. Has anyone seen the cover of September's National Geographic magazine? If you haven't, if you can, take a look. It's on. It shows I think it's an MRI or a scan or whatever you call them, of a human brain. It's a cool looking picture. And the caption across the top of the magazine is addiction. And of course, they immediately had my attention. And I haven't read the article yet, but I'm curious. But I will bet you, I will just bet you dollars to donuts that somewhere in this article describes a scientist or some group of people that are coming up with a pill. You know where this is going. They're going to invent a pill that is going to help those of us who suffer from addictions to cure them. Forget the side effects. I mean, that's only half. This is like fixing our thinking with our thinking. I'm going to think my way through this and solve whatever problem, right? I mean, we just make ourselves crazier. And some of us have been listening to this for generations. They're about to come up with a pill, you know, to deal with, you know, compulsions and obsessions like alcoholism and drug addiction. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you betcha. Yeah, taking a pill to handle an addiction. Just think about it. But do you see, I mean, it's a goofy example, But this is how we seem to be wired as a people, as a culture. There's always got to be something on the outside that's going to fix our insides. And what Jesus is talking about, the observation that he's offering his friends and his followers, it's an observation, okay, is that every time we do that, every time we try to fix our insides with something from the outside, it's doomed to fail. It's not going to work. And in effect, what Jesus is offering his friends and followers, not just in the first century of the Common Era, but down through the ages, right on to the present, is, please, guys, pay attention, says Jesus. You're looking at spiritual maladies that require spiritual solutions. Not stuff. Oh, if I had the right house. Oh, if I had the right wife or husband. Oh, if I had the right job. Oh, if, you know, my kids would shut up and pay attention to me. Good luck with that one. On and on it goes. All this stuff that we get so wrapped up on the outside, when what Jesus basically, and this is not unusual, I mean, every spiritual teacher, every wisdom teacher, if you will, and Jesus, make no mistake, is a wisdom teacher in the ancient tradition, says, guys, it's an inside job. And so if you and I are willing to simply surrender to the universe, to a power greater than ourselves, divine presence, God, whatever, however you want to imagine that, if we're willing to just give up this crazy thinking of fixing our insides with something from the outside, we just might find our lives. We might find our center, we might find our being, and we might find all kinds of amazing and creative ways with the energy to go with it to be of service to the world and to the people around us. That's what he's talking about. If you try to save your life, you're going to lose it. It's just how it seems to work. Try to fill the insides with something from the outside, doomed to fail. It just is. It's a basic spiritual axiom. Jesus is not making this up. It goes way back into the ancient tradition. So, file that by title. Spiritual maladies require spiritual solutions. And I have to tell you, from the vantage point of being a priest and apparently now the longest serving priesthood, which, I don't quite know what to make of that. Except to feel sorry for you. It is amazing to me, as the years go by, all of the things, you know, the pain, the anguish, the heartbreak, the compulsions, the obsessions, the addiction, you name it, the whole gamut of human misery and suffering, I'm continuously amazed how all of those things seem to be addressed by some kind of spiritual, basic, non-highfalutin spiritual solutions and basic principles. It astonishes me to this day. And so, again, I'm grateful for this life of service that I live, because I receive constant reminders of the very thing that Jesus is offering his friends and followers. You want to find your life whole? The translation of saved is, do you want to find your life whole? Do you want to be made whole? Not fixed, but whole. Then lose it. Surrender. You know, give it up, as it were. Come out with your hands up, my favorite image. Some old TV show. You are surrounded. Yeah. Okay. Then it gets a little more interesting. I mean, you have this exchange between Jesus and Peter and, you know, the whole get behind me, Satan. Again, this is not, no one's getting condemned here. You know, Jesus isn't doing the smackdown on Peter. In fact, actually, they've kind of done the smackdown on each other. It's sort of equal among equals here. And then here comes the zinger. If any want to become my followers, and let me just say, so the scene is that there's this group of people that have been following Jesus around the Palestine. Okay? It's already a given. He's already got them. They're already there. I mean, this is what's happening. And yet, he says, if any want to become my followers, and there's one of those little clues, some of that code language that I've referred to in the past, that lets us know that this isn't just Jesus talking to the people that hung out with him when he was alive. This is also the writer of the Gospel according to Matthew talking to his people late in the first century of the Common Era. And then it goes on to say, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. And this is where some of us begin to get a little nervous. Uh-oh. Am I supposed to become some sort of self-righteous martyr? And the answer is, please don't. You know, if your impulses take you in that direction, please keep it to yourself. Okay. Just wanted to put that one out there. But here's how to understand what's really going on. Now, last week in the gospel reading, we heard that, again, this is Jesus moving around the Palestine. He's gone north, north of Jerusalem, and they are now standing outside the city of Caesarea Philippi. And they're on the outside, and they're looking in, and it's vital that we understand the nature of this place in order to understand what it is that Jesus is talking about and the invitation that he has just issued. So here goes. In the first century, the Common Era, the various local leaders, procurators, wannabe kings and whatnot who occupied the Palestine on behalf of Caesar Augustus, in their own enlightened self-interest, decided to build some cities in honor of the Caesar and his various family members. And so, of course, like Herod, for instance, enslaved the Jewish nation to build these monuments, these cities, as peons to Caesar and his family. One of them happened to be Caesarea Philippi, another one, which I've actually visited, on the coastline of the eastern Mediterranean, Caesarea Maritima, and these cities were built specifically to entertain the Roman legions who were destroying the rest of the countryside. In other words, Caesarea Philippi, Caesarea Maritima, were built as pleasure pads, if you will, for the soldiers, whose job it was to ensure that the Pax Romana, the Peace of Rome, was going to be enforced at all costs, including, we will have peace at the cost of your life. We will kill you, and then maybe others will cooperate, and then we'll establish peace. Sound familiar? Yeah. Imperial powers have been doing this since, you know, the beginning of, maybe not the beginning of time, but the beginning of imperial powers. And so there they are, Jesus, his followers, standing outside looking into the pleasure pads of Rome, and it's a party going on in there. I mean, all the debauchery you can imagine is going down in Caesarea Philippi, because those soldiers are going to have to go back out in the field. Get it while you can, says Rome, because you're going to have to go back out in the fields and destroy people's lives and crops. And it's a lot of work. I mean, you know, it takes some effort to destroy people's homes and villages and livelihoods and families. I mean, you know, take some doing. So get it while you can. So there they are. And last week, you may recall, Jesus opens this scene once they land outside of Caesarea Philippi. He says to them, oh, well, who do you say the Son of Man or the Son of God is? Who is that? Now, anyone who's paying attention, standing outside of Caesarea Philippi with half a brain is going to have one answer to that question and one answer only. Anybody want to guess what it was? Say it louder. Yeah. Who's the Son of Man? Who's the Son of God? Who's in charge? Caesar, they would say. And Peter, being the doof that he is, says, because he's been cruising around with Jesus for a while, and he's kind of slowly picking up on the vibe, and he doesn't quite know what this means, but he finds himself saying out loud, oh, you are the Messiah, he says to Jesus. And as soon as those words come out of his mouth, he has got a target on his back as far as Imperial Rome is concerned. And when word gets out that a guy like Peter, this know-nothing fisherman from the Sea of Galilee, has said what he said, he is a seditionist, he is a terrorist, and he will be dealt with as only Imperial Rome can do. And he, along with thousands of other Jewish people who are basically not saying, oh, Caesar is the Son of God, hail Caesar, blah, blah. They've all got targets on their back, and they will be dealt with, and they will be crucified. It's how Rome established the Peace of Rome. You don't cooperate, we kill you, and better yet, we torture you and make an example of you by hanging you publicly on a cross and lining the streets of whatever city you happen to be in, so that the rest of the population kind of gets the message that we're not to be trifled with. And Jesus knows this. He knows where he's standing. He knows the question he's asking, and he knows the consequences of any answer beyond, oh, Caesar, hail Caesar. And so there's deep and abiding irony going on in this scene. I mean, again, if you can just picture this city of, you know, Roman pleasure, whatever, fueling the violence of Imperial Rome, and then this conversation between Jesus and his friends going on. You kind of get what the deal is. And so in the first century of the Common Era, when we hear these words, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me, this is not metaphorical language as we might interpret it now in the 21st century. They are hearing this and experiencing this literally, because right on through Jesus' time in the early first century, the Common Era, right on through the end of the first century, into the second century, and well into the third century, these people, these followers of Jesus, these Jewish followers of Jesus, are being hunted down by Imperial Rome and put to death as examples of what happens to you when you do not cooperate with the imperial power. And so when he says, in this context, in Matthew's gospel, take up your cross, everybody's kind of going, okay. All right, well, at least we know the consequences of our declarations and of our actions. And here's the deal. This is not an invitation issued by Jesus to his followers, nor was it understood by the end of the first century of the Common Era when this gospel was written. This is not an invitation to become a self-righteous martyr. It's not what's going on here. Jesus was not a self-righteous martyr. Jesus' willingness to face the consequences of his preaching, his teaching, his way of life, the healings, the wholeness that happened around him, and the way that that garnered the attention of Imperial Rome, was a willingness to be killed at the hands of the imperial power in order to witness to a life of non-violent resistance. Let me say that again. The cross, as Jesus understood it, faced it, lived it, and died it, if that's a phrase, was not to be a self-righteous martyr. All that stuff about blood sacrifice and, you know, I mean, the whole bit that we've touted over the last, you know, 1700 years, forget all. This symbol of torture, of imperial power, he takes on willingly in order to live a life of non-violent resistance to imperial power. And his invitation to take up the cross and follow is basically to do the same. And so you and I today, here in the 21st century, we are still, unfortunately, familiar with the nature of imperial power, are we not? I mean, we know what it looks like. We're actually pretty comfortable with it. I mean, and it can embody in all kinds of ways. I mean, something as simple as creating and adhering to a system that allows wealthy people to build more wealth on the backs of the poor, that's imperial power. I mean, on and on it goes. And from the vantage point of Jesus and the heart of the gospel tradition, you and I are invited to live a life that witnesses to a different way of moving through the world. A way where we hear from the vantage point of the gospel tradition and from the vantage point of the scriptures that God would have us organize ourselves in a very different kind of way. Where everyone in this life and everyone that lives on the planet has an opportunity to live full, productive lives. And that you and I can participate in both envisioning and moving toward that kind of world. And it's one that imperial powers ain't much interested in. So, that means it's time to end. So, I leave you with those thoughts. Again, we're going to be coming back to this. But imagine standing outside, on the outside looking in, of a pleasure palace like Caesarea Philippi and having a conversation like this with Jesus and making some basic decisions about to whom we're going to be beholden. Take a moment.